Our next speaker shared with me a moment ago that in most of the gatherings that he addresses, he's the only one present that doesn't exhibit body piercings or tattoos. But he feels, in that sense at least, very much one of us today. But if there are those present who have body piercings and tattoos, we'd like it if you'd come down in the front so he'd feel more comfortable and at home in this setting. You don't have to show the tattoo to come forward. Reverend Tim Conder comes to us from Durham, North Carolina, to be with us, where he is the founding pastor of Emmaus Way, which can be described with any number of adjectives. It is emergent, it is organic, it is an intentional, missional church community located not far from Duke's campus, which I understand is something of a cross-cultural ministry for a Carolina man. So he's familiar firsthand with bridging cultural gaps. Before founding Emmaus Way, he served as pastor of a Bible church for 15 years, and he also now serves on the board of directors of the Mars Hill Graduate School in Seattle. He is the author of The Church in Transition, The Journey of Existing Churches into the Emerging Culture, from Zondervan, a book which I hope many of you have a chance to become familiar with. He'll help us reflect on what it means for existing churches to be confronted with new realities in our culture and new expectations of church. Reverend Tim Conder, thank you for being with us.
I had to actually go buy a blazer last night. I needed to have at least the theological look, and something I had to purchase.
I'd like to be with you guys. I don't know what your definition of fear is, but and my kids would. Maybe I should move this mic a little bit. How are we doing, a little better there? Well, I'm not sure what your definition of fear is. I think my kids, who are 12 and 10 years old, they're to face down.
All righty.
Should we let's turn this off. Should we just, what if I set it aside?
You want to use, I think they want you to use that. Let's ditch the wireless. Apologies to Bart.
No problem. That's exactly right. I think we'll be okay with this. But my kid's definition of fear is probably something to do with Voldemort, but here's my definition of fear, is being up after a Harvard demographic professor, getting ready to make a speech or talk or dialogue about social realities that to me are realities based on experience and ministry that's based on intuition. So I sat in the back, the other room, just sitting there going, oh, please God, let these statistics be somewhat bearing of the things I'm going to say. And I can honestly say to you that I had kind of a whew, moment, we're okay. And truly, I have appreciated the whole conversation as it's come to this point, because in some ways, even the last question that was raised a little bit about missional activity and kind of reaching out to different generations, is it relates to some of the things that we're going to talk about. And in my community and the congregation that I lead, I am obsessively old. In fact, I catch most of them saying things like, oh yeah, that old guy, he's got to be at least in his 40s. And I look at them and I realize they don't remember that I'm 46. But anyway, so it's a different setting for me and some ways in the church that I lead. But I wanted to read something. This is from the Emergent Manifesto of Hope. This is a chapter that I wrote. It's a little bit of an autobiographical statement about myself that might give you a little bit of an idea of where I want to go today. It begins, I am one of many who have witnessed and experienced the accelerating momentum of the emerging church from both inside and outside. I've often been the lost son of Luke's narrative, finding a redemptive space and a warm home in the embrace of the emergent community. But at times I've been forced by vocation to stand on the outside of the party like the older brother. I've watched this emergent community experience so many changes, from being virtually unnoticed to struggling to manage the interest generated, from predominantly deconstructing traditional Christianity to having a seat at the table in many institutional expressions of Christianity, from being defined by its ideological differences and eccentricities to being identified by the creativity and impact of its communities, from being a harmless curiosity to a target of harsh criticism and a focal point of fear, from a posture of prophetic criticism of the Enlightenment and modernity to poetic creativity and apostolic braveness in this postmodern world that we live in. I've also experienced these same changes from the outside. Most of my tenure as a leader within the emergent community has occurred while serving as a pastor of a mainstream evangelical church that has both confluences with and some significantly divergent philosophical, theological sensitivities from those in the emergent community. In this environment, I've heard many of the fears and critiques of emergent. I have been sensitized to occasions when the emerging church has caricatured the existing church, and I've seen some of the contemporary norms of Christian community that demand a movement such as this. I say all that to just say that in many ways, I am truly a dual citizen. I have lived in the existing church as a pastor of a college town church of 1,500 to 2,000 folks, and have seen some of the most amazing things that can happen in the existing church. I've also, through my career, seen just so many things that I feel need to change within Christianity. And we're going to talk about some of those changes, and I hope that you will hear that as I present those things. I want to present them very graciously, because there's probably more places that I'm wrong than I'm right, but I do sense within the existing church, and I'm defining the existing church really as the whole structure of established institutional church in our culture, there are places where I think we profoundly need to change. I've also had great experiences in the emerging church. I've seen some of the most amazing, passionate, creative things over the last 10 to 15 years. I've seen things happening in Christendom that I never thought I would see. I've seen just, it's been some of the most exciting things I've ever seen. But I've also seen the naivete of the emerging church in places where this new movement desperately needs the institutional and existing church. So I've seen its weaknesses as well. The thing that has changed in my life is now I'm an emerging church planner, so I'm the one that's calling up conferences and begging to come for free or a reduced rate. I no longer have the big church expense account, and my life has changed radically. So I'm kind of looking at the whole emerging church movement very much more, not just from the national inside, but now from the local inside. So that's just a little bit about who I am. And literally, as I was listening to Dr. Putnam today, my reaction to him as I listened to the statistics that he presented was a couple of quick reactions to his presentation. Is one, I think the culture that we live in does desperately need two churches. The existing church and the emerging church, I think, somehow fit in this cultural landscape that was somehow portrayed in the many statistics that he presented. The other thing I would say is in his commentary on issues of plurality and tolerance, which I know that many would hear negatively, and there's some things that we would probably respond to critically, my reaction to was there's hope. There's hope in our culture that we can have kind of two expressions of Christendom operating side by side. And my hope and dream in talking to you about this, and really my thesis and things that I've been writing and caring a good deal about, is trying to draw the emerging church and the existing church into a conversation that moves way past collaboration to a missional friendship. So that's really the dream that I want to express today. But let me throw out a few assumptions. And I know that I'm going to use some language that for some might be highly familiar and for others might be entirely unfamiliar. And this may be a mistake, but I'm not going to spend a ton of time defining emerging church or postmodern expressions of church, because there's some amazing resources out there. And in some ways, I want to move to the conversation between these two churches. But let me throw out a few presuppositions that might be helpful to you. This is my thought on the existing church, is that I think the existing church needs to exist. that there is ministry going on in our culture and in our world that's absolutely fabulous. There have been many times when I've been around some of the most far out, creative, artistic people, and they come up with an idea that I know has already been expressed significantly in some of the existing churches that I know. So I am not one of those people that believes in kind of a reformation by extermination for the institutional church. There are some that certainly believe that. That's not my posture as it relates to the existing church. In terms of the emerging church, I, as an insider, and I know that I'm very biased, but that's somewhat postmodern of me to be biased and proud of it, is that I truly think that the emerging church, and in its very broad definition, is a powerful movement of God's Spirit. It's part of a great reformation that's going on. Authors like Phyllis Tickle and others are referring to the era that we live in as kind of a next reformation, and I do believe that the emerging church plays a really significant place in that. Here's my little soundbite, and I apologize that this is a soundbite, but this is my soundbite on the emerging church. My friend John Franke, who wrote a wonderful book with Stan Grintz about 5 or 6 years ago called Beyond Foundationalism, his kind of pithy answer about what postmodernism is he refers to it as a kind of a hermeneutics of finitude, meaning that in postmodernity, there's this mindset that one doesn't make transcendent statements. One makes finite and local statements. That anything that's transcendent, overwhelming, meta-narratives, things like that, are to be suspicious. And that's actually the second part of postmodernity, is a hermeneutics of suspicion. So Tom over here makes some comment that seems to be an overarching, powerful statement. If I'm a postmodern philosopher, I'm going to be somewhat skeptical of that, because in some ways that's where I'm fearing that somebody's going to do some form of violence or generalization to me. So that's his quick definition of postmodernity. The emerging church is the church that's taking shape in postmodernity. But if you've noticed, the language has changed dramatically. I mean, 10, 12 years ago, we kind of recklessly, like a bunch of 16-year-olds who had just gotten their driver's license, ran around talking about the postmodern church as if we were in some sort of cheerleader costume for postmodernity, which is certainly not the case. When I talk about postmodernity, I really refer to it as it's the oxygen that we breathe. It's a part of a profound cultural shift that our vote on doesn't necessarily matter, because it's a shift that's coming. But when referring to the emerging church, a good definition, this comes from Dwight Friesen, who's a faculty member at Mars Hill Graduate School, would say, hey, emergent people tend to be about two things. One is contextuality, which was said pretty boldly in the previous session, that we deeply believe in the importance of context as it relates to mission. And the second part of kind of emerging church mindset is hope. There's a belief that besides thinking about what God is doing contextually, that there's a great redemptive hope. And that redemptive hope is not just an eternity. It's not just a future hope, but it's a hope of a redemption that's happening in this place, that the kingdom is both present and future for us. So that's just maybe something to kind of hang your hat on in terms of emerging church. I know we could have a long conversation about this. One more assumption that I make is, and this is one that, again, would be a great conversation, is that I believe in transition. I think that a transition in ministry is absolutely necessary. As we think about community formation, spiritual formation, the understanding of what the posture of worship is, particularly the holistic posture of standing before God, our identity and our mission, all of these things need to very radically change as we move into more of a postmodern, and a term that I still use too, is in some ways a post-Christian society. And I realize that postmodernity and post-Christianity are probably best understood as contextual statements, in the sense that that's a big debate of how much would post-modern society affect all of America. How much of America will look like a post-Christian society to some degree? Because it was what was said by Dr. Putnam very well this morning, is that America has not followed the path of Europe. Our society does not look in the same way that post-modern Europe is. As a matter of fact, European postmodern philosophy is quite different from those in the United States who have interest in that area. So again, I understand that that would probably be a pretty lively debate. And I understand that my perspective is pretty biased because I've lived in a college town for 20 years. I do some professional work in Seattle, and I'm pretty comfortable declaring Seattle a very post-Christian state. And what are the statistics? Maybe 6% of church attendance. And when I mention those statistics to some in North Carolina, they're absolutely shocked, as if I'm describing that on the planet Pluto, less than 10% of the people, because it's alien to them. But I do live in a very liberal community. The triangle between Chapel Hill and Durham and Raleigh is, I believe, the highest concentration of PhDs in the world. So I understand that in some ways we're freaks. Being standing before you without a PhD, I often like to say that I'm really the dumbest person on my block because I'm the only one without a PhD. And so in some ways I understand that my perspective is biased, but where I live, post-Christian and post-modern society are absolutely thriving, and unless you're able to embrace them, you're probably not doing a lot of ministry unless you're evangelizing the already evangelized or those who were once evangelized and need to be evangelized again. So in some ways there are powerful realities, but I realize that in some way we could have a great conversation about how significant and how dramatic they are. But one thing I'm quite confident of is that you will have to embrace postmodernity. You will have to embrace post-Christianity to do ministry. I remember when I first started talking about this in the mid-90s, this is in Chapel Hill, I was still doing a lot of youth work at the time, and I had a group of parents, and I was, you know, crazy youth pastor talking to them about postmodernity, and they wanted me to tell their kids how far is too far, but I was interested in these philosophical matters. And I remember one parent raising his hand. He said, and in Chapel Hill, where we were, it was a huge homeschool community, about 50 to 60% of the kids in our church were homeschooled, and there are two types of homeschoolers at that point in Chapel Hill. Some were the culture flight folks, and the other were the post-hippies that really didn't want boundaries on the, you know, so it was a pretty, that was a diverse community. And one day, dad, who is a PhD in chemistry, you know, brilliant guy, stood up and said, you know, my kids are homeschooled. I'm quite confident that they have no postmodern influences in their life. And as they said this, you know, you could see half the room starting to smirk. And finally, somebody kind of put him out of his misery and raised their hand and said, you know, homeschooling is a postmodern phenomenon. And that was one of the things that he went to kind of chew on for a little bit. But if the if the emerging church and the existing church are going to be in conversation with each other, if they're both necessary, and again, what we saw this morning is that we live in a very polarized world, and so in some sense, it's quite necessary for us to have multiple expressions of Christianity. So if they are going to both exist and they're going to collaborate, then I think it's very important that they understand what their identities are and then certainly what their collisions are. Now, let me describe just, I've Emergent Manifesto of Hope, by the way, is a good book on in terms of kind of getting the breadth of the emergent movement. And the chapter that I wrote kind of goes into a lot of differences between these churches. But I want to focus in on two because they might be perhaps the most polemic differences. And let us kind of chew for a moment on what are some of the collisions that come to play in this. One is that the existing church and the emerging church have two really different opinions on ethics and on community formation. Let's chew on ethics for just a minute. The existing church, for the most part, has reserved a lot of its language. This is not entirely true for Catholics, and it's certainly not true at times for mainline Christians, but a lot of our ethical language has been focused on personal ethics, personal decisions, personal morality. We've kind of, for every comment that we've made on social ethics, we tend to make 9 or 10 on personal ethics. And in some ways, when we talk about ethical things, we typically have some pretty profound, specific commitments to kind of individual choices that we value. I'll give you a little bit of a caricature of this. This is coming from the great philosopher Don Condor, who is my dad, and has this great ability of saying things in the way that you just would never imagine. So my dad and I grew up in a Southern Baptist home, rural North Carolina. We were teetotalers. Our vision of alcohol, anyone who imbibed in alcohol was either an alcoholic, Somebody who had deep social problems with their life. They just didn't know them yet, and they were headed for the gutter. That was the only exposure that we had with alcohol. So you can imagine kind of coming from that setting to a pretty upper middle class high school, and then the University of North Carolina was kind of eye-opening for me, because I started to see people who drank alcohol who didn't appear to be alcoholics, and they didn't appear to be felons in some way, and it was kind of a different experience. In fact, my small group Bible study for InterVarsity at UNC, I think the drinking age was 18, by the way, back then. But we used to meet for happy hour at 5 o'clock on Friday nights before going about our business on the weekend. So needless to say, there was a little bit of a paradigm collision going on there. So I went home and I was talking to my dad about this. And my dad has the gift of generalization. So he was kind of making great gold statements on that. And finally, I said, Dad, just imagine this. I mean, you're sitting in the house alone and there's a knock on the back door. You open the back door, and there stands Jesus holding a six-pack. And Jesus says, Don, you know, I'd just love to split this six-pack with you and sit down and have a really good conversation about the things that matter in the world. And my dad shot back immediately, I would just have to have faith that that would never happen. And you know, I was like, Dad, you've said it all right there. But and I realize that's a little bit of a straw man argument, but it's a caricature. But when we talk about ethics, a lot of times the conversation has been on personal moral choices. In the emerging church, the conversation about ethics, for the most part, has been deeply influenced by systemic thoughts, systemic realities. So there are huge conversations about social ethics and corporate ethics. And this is the first thing that's the first word out of the mouth of many, many emergent people is some conversation on social ethics. I remember at one point doing an outreach thing for high school students 10 or 15 years ago. This is Chapel Hill kids. I mean, when Jerry Garcia died, I had to make about 10 pastoral calls in my youth group because there were a number of guys that were destroying their guitars and threatening to jump out windows. But so I understand it's a pretty countercultural place. But when I did this outreach, we did the typical speaker, band, and pizza, the kind of the staple of youth ministry. And I had kids that came up from Chapel Hill High School, and they were holding kind of styrofoam plates, like those were like a bucket of roaches or something like that. And they said, kind of, what do we do with these? And they had their plastic bottles, and they said, where do we recycle these? And there wasn't a recycling plan, and there certainly wasn't an environmentally sensitive plan for that evening. And you could see the look of dismissal that they had for us. We were felons in their eyes. If we're not thinking of those things, then this Jesus guy is not a good guy for them. And so one of the things that I think is really difficult in the emerging church, existing church conversation is that both churches thinks the other is immoral. The other, because the thought is that if you don't have my passion for social ethics, then you're not a good person. And I'm not that into, I don't care about your truth. You're not very good. And I'm afraid of you. And it goes back and forth. When we were starting a kind of an emergent community in my evangelical church, people used to come up and their first questions would be, are you going to practice an open communion? What if a homosexual attends? What if people are living together? What if people are, they're primary questions were about personal ethics, and if there were differences on those questions, then the conversation was over. So that's one of the biggest collisions that we face, is that both churches tend to accuse the other of immorality. Another issue that's different is the whole idea of community formation. How do we form communities? And in the existing church, and certainly in the Reformation Protestant church, we tend to form community based on doctrine and confession. So if your church is a triangle, it looks like a triangle because your doctrine is shaped like a triangle. The doctrine forms the boundaries. It forms the borders. It defines the space. If your church is a square, then your doctrine is a square. And so that is pretty much the normal approach to ministry, is to be defined by doctrine. In the emerging church, the shape of the community is, and understand, and I'm going to make several comments about this later, but and this is not a disdain for doctrine. In fact, there's a very significant place for doctrine. But in the emerging church, the shape of the community is often defined by ethical and missional commitments. So it means a great deal for people to understand and be able to speak an ethical language of people who are committed to the redemptive mission of Christ. And so that missional language is where we lead, whereas the existing church often leads with doctrinal language. And you can imagine that that creates some fairly significant collisions. I'll give you an example kind of in my own setting. When I was a youth pastor, and again, I was in a very postmodern setting. This was in the early 90s. I had a youth leader who was fabulous. He understood the mission. He understood the vision of our church as a volunteer. Just a tremendous sense of integrity related to kids. Was a school teacher. But he struggled with our church. And he struggled with our church on some of the same reasons that I'm talking to you about. Is that he was wondering where's the language of social responsibility. That too often in our preaching we present the exegesis of the scriptures as always a clear and definable and non-negotiable point. What about the parts in the Bible that seem to be in tension with each other? And he had a whole list of concerns related to the language and ministry of our church, but he understood that he was different, and he understood that he was still very, very, very much committed to the mission of our body, even though there were theological differences. Well, with his permission, I actually shared it in our staff community, because one of the concerns that I had in being an evangelical pastor is that our gospel was a bit reductionistic, is that there were portions of the gospel that we were pretty committed to, and there are other things that seem pretty gospel-like that we were less committed about. So we brought this conversation to bear, and I mentioned this person's feedback. Well, one of my colleagues, we had a co-pastor system, so we were peers, but one of my colleagues said, you know, you've got to ask him to leave. I mean, he can no longer work with our kids. And the irony was that this guy had struggling kids, and they were being amazingly reached out to by this volunteer. But again, he says, he's got to leave. And I didn't do it. That was not the way that I thought that I should do business. Well, about 5 years later, we had a pretty significant dispute over an issue on our staff team. And this colleague said to me, you know, I've never really trusted you as a professional person since when you didn't make that decision to ask John to leave. And he put it in the language of personal integrity. And I was tremendously offended. I walked away saying, I may not come back, or he may not come back. You know, that's what in the co-pastor system, you know, it's kind of like who can fire who, and that's kind of a confusing thing to do. But you know, we had a problem. And as I reflected on that problem at great length, I realized, you know, he used the language of personal integrity, but I don't think he really means that. What he understands is that once you step off the doctrinal bus, you're no longer on the bus. I mean, you're not firing somebody. You're asking them to acknowledge what has already happened. They're no longer part of this community. But in my understanding of community, John's ethical and missional commitments, which were right in line, and his clear understanding of our doctrine, made him an absolutely wonderful youth pastor. But you can see the collision that happens in that setting, because in some ways, we're really describing two entirely different functions of community. Did anybody see, maybe it was last week's Christianity Today, there was an article about Mark Driscoll in there. Does anybody know Christianity Today readers? That's actually says probably a really good thing here. It's not the New York Times, but there was an article about Mark Driscoll, who is a pastor up in Seattle, and has a pretty significantly large church, 6,000 or 7,000 folks. And Mark was a part of Emergent when it was founded in the early 90s. And as we started kind of talking about what we thought and believed, Mark's belief system was very, very, very much more defined and conservative than other people in the group, so to speak. And so this article kind of talks about Mark and his kind of original days in Emergent, and then his kind of movement to a different theological place along the way. But a couple of friends of mine were asked to comment on that, and one, Doug Padgett, said, you know, when we talk to each other, we remain friends, but it does seem like we're describing two entirely different narratives of Christianity. Now, that in some ways at its most base level is perhaps the greatest collision between the emerging church and the existing church. Without even a language of advocacy here, at times we're describing two really different stories of Christianity. But you know, I am amazingly hopeful as it relates to this. I do believe that these two churches kind of taking shape in our culture, one that has a long history and the one that has kind of a revolutionary and reforming spirit, I really do believe that there is collaboration and there's missional friendship out there. And what I'd like to do, kind of this is the part that I do want to make some statements of advocacy, is I want to describe three movements that I think are significant for these two churches. And I want to say these movements graciously, because I understand that my context is different from yours, that I've been invited into a denominational setting, and you're not going to agree with everything that I say, and who knows, I might be wrong about what I'm saying, but to some degree, I want to describe kind of a missiology that I think will draw these three churches together, and especially, this would be one of the best outcomes for this, is it would provoke a pretty significant, respectful conversation between these two groups, because I think that would be absolutely fabulous for our culture. So the first movement is this. I would encourage us to develop a much more dynamic exegesis of culture. And interestingly, I would encourage the existing church to turn that exegesis of culture perhaps more inward, and I would encourage the emerging church to turn that exegesis of culture more outward. Let me explain what I mean by that. In some sense, one of the things that I would love for existing churches to begin to realize is to embrace some postmodern sensitivity about the influences of our context and our experiences on our assertions and our propositions and our theology. And one of the things that I tend to challenge people about is that I think it's significant to begin to step back from this thing we call the gospel and perhaps not refer to it as an entirely pure notion. The assertion being this, that what we call the gospel is not affected whatsoever by the culture that we live in. Now, again, I'm speaking pretty clearly in kind of a postmodern perspective on that, but I do think that that's one of the weaknesses of the existing church, is its belief in an absolutely pure gospel. Now, I was presenting that in my home church, and you can imagine the hands that went up, and I was kind of in a Sunday school class one time of the people who had founded the church 30 or 40 years later. Several hands went up, and the dominant question with that was, can you give me one example, just one example, of how our culture has affected the gospel that we've taught and preached over the last 50 to 100 years. And of course, as a Southerner, this is like a 6-inch putt, because in every pulpit in my town, segregation was defended until the late 60s to early 70s, and was defended on grounds of gospel understanding. But then I go on and say, here's one of the things that we do miss, is in this gospel that we present, materialism, individualism, rights, language, entitlement, all of these things are deeply embedded, not only in how we describe the gospel, but how we methodologically present the gospels to others. We are highly individualistic. We are highly materialistic. One of the things that's very, very common in our churches is a benefits Christianity. People are kind of out there saying, like Kevin Costner in the cornfield and Field of Dreams, I don't want to ask what's in it for me, but what's in it for me? And we've talked a little bit about the consumerism that does drive our churches. And I hear of, I was watching television with my wife on vacation, and I don't know why I do this. This is voyeurism at its very worst kind of voyeurism on television. It's occasionally I turn to religious broadcasts just so I can get really mad and practice throwing things at the television. It's a great way to just really get angry about things. So I'm watching this interview of this pastor. I hope he's not here. But if so, I disagree. And he was talking about how their growth was so affected by the fact that they had this raffle ministry. So people would come in once a month, and under every seat in the church was a taped key. And it's kind of like a Eucharistic function. Everybody got to come up and jam the key into like a new Volvo or something like that. And somebody took the Volvo home. And he said, next month we're getting phenomenally radical. We're giving away a Harley. And you know, we laugh about that, but in truth, a lot of our church organization is so based on notions of consumerism. I remember back kind of, you know, the Seeker Church movement actually began more as a youth ministry movement. And influenced by that some, I came in the late 80s in Chapel Hill and did some things that kind of growth-oriented that had competition. And my postmodern Chapel Hill kids said, "Dude, why do we want to compete with the people who are part of this community?" I mean, it just didn't make any sense to them. But I would suggest that one of the things that we need to do in the existing church is that we need to do some cultural exegesis turned inward toward our methods and our message. And I would suggest that both of those things have been affected by the culture that we live in. Now, am I canceling out the gospel? Absolutely not. Are there convictions and things that I would absolutely die for? Of course. But I think that if we're unwilling to critique what we do culturally, we're going to miss the point of the emerging church. Now, I would say the exact same thing to the emerging church, but to direct it outwardly. I was in a phenomenal church in the Midwest a year or two, about 4 or 5 years ago, and a church that I love and think's absolutely fantastic, and they were doing announcements. And with their announcements, they did about a 5-minute announcement, and as a Lord of the Rings geek, I appreciated this announcement, but it was the first installment, Fellowship of the Ring, was about to come out. And they did a 5-minute announcement of how the whole church was going together and where to meet and how much the tickets were and how to drive them. I mean, it was a really long announcement. I was getting excited. I was pulling my money out. And then the person who did the announcement stopped and said, "Oh, and by the way, we've got this baptism next week, and I think that'll be great too." And then they went on. And I was sitting beside the senior pastor, and he, you know, all of you, I know a lot of you are senior pastors, and you have that horrific wince moment when something that's done in your name that you would never do it that way. That was that moment for him. Is he's like, "I can't believe we just talked 5 minutes about a movie, and then we did baptism in about 7 seconds, a soundbite." And I would say that to the emerging church is the emerging church really does need to at times take a critical view of cultural entanglement and wrestle with Paul's words in 1 Corinthians 8 through 10 and asking what are matters of temple worship that need to be avoided and what are missional possibilities that need to be embraced. And that's a very challenging conversation. But for those of us who have been in a very culturally sensitive ministry world, there are times when we lack sensitivity, and I could give several examples in my own church where we do that. So I think that's step one is cultural exegesis. Step two is I would encourage us to have a less selective view of history. In a lot of the churches, and this is none of these are Missouri Synod churches, but in a lot of the churches that I speak at, there are three favorite eras of church history. One is the first century church. Don't ask me why. The second is that moment in the Reformation when your guys were in charge. And then the third moment is the recent past, why we decided to paint the floor blue, or, you know, what the last pastor did. Those three parts of church history are truly significant in most communities. But what you find is so many of the emerging church sensitivities of narrative, mystery, artistic beauty, things like that, come out of the whole narrative of God's redemptive work. And so my challenge to existing churches is that we need to take much more seriously the narrative of pre-Christian Judaism and of pre-Reformation Christianity. That story is significant to us. And in so many ways, it's not having been educated in a very reformed seminary. And notice how different. I mean, I'm involved in a school now. I mean, the conversations when I went to school 25 years ago, ethics were for people who couldn't take hard classes, patristics for people who couldn't handle systematic theology. I mean, you know, our whole interest in theological education has probably shifted. We didn't use the language of spiritual direction or spiritual formation. It was often very, you know, things have changed dramatically. But I do think that in some ways we've got to look at the broad view of the church's story, and I think that's tremendously significant. For the emerging church, I think the emerging church does need to appreciate the genius of the Reformation. I think that the emerging church as it exists now stands on the shoulders of the Reformation in many ways. This is a quote, as I wanted to read it to you the way I wrote it on this, because I feel strongly about this. We need to find our heritage less in Foucault and postmodern deconstructionists and more in the formative thoughts of Reformation theologians whose battle with modernity carved our path into postmodernity. And in the 15 years that I've been involved with Emergent, there has been amazing creativity and there have been at times amazing arrogance. And in many ways, I used to come home at times and my wife would say to me, "Why do you hang out with those people? Because they offend you so much and they make you so angry." Because I was the older, non-tattooed, non-goateed, established church guy, you know, doing big church things, which are not marks of credibility in that community. And so many times they would describe some amazingly creative thing that they were inventing. And I'm like, gosh, guys, I'm in a post-60s kind of hippie church. We've kind of invented plurality and leadership. You're trying to work it out. We've got this crazy church where every pastor has the same salary. We don't value the teaching pastor more than the children's pastor because we both see those as deeply powerful acts of God. You have not invented creativity. And so I've had this wonderful window into an existing church that's now approaching 40 years old that has done some amazing things. And I bet if we had a kumbaya moment, you guys could all come forward here and tell some absolutely amazing things that are happening in your fellowship. So I do think the emerging church has to understand that we stand on the shoulders of things that have come before us. And here's an anathema. The seeker church movement, the Jesus movement, and all of these things, they have had great influences on the emerging church. Even though we've been perhaps the prophets of critique against the seeker church model, because it certainly did not work kind of post-baby boom America, to some degree, their sense of missionality, their a discovery of context, they're looking at culture, were the things that gave us the permission to take very seriously what many of us perceived was a postmodern shift going on in our culture. So that's really a second step. Here's the third step. And I will honestly say that kind of I do these kind of church in transition seminars where we kind of spend like a couple days talking about what does this mean for existing churches. And when I get to this point, it takes me about 7 minutes to say, but it lasts about 4 to 5 hours and I have to like stop it because I understand that this is a fairly controversial point. But let me present this out here is that, and as I say this, one of the things I think that we need to do is begin moving theological dialogue from the boundaries of community to the safe spaces, the inner spaces of theological imagination. So again, in most existing churches, we have formed our communities around our doctrinal assertions. You can watch, you can enjoy, you can contribute, but to really participate, you need to confess and affirm the same doctrine. And in many churches, churches that are less in-depth with this, you may even have to use the exact same language that we use to describe the same concepts. So our churches are often shaped around doctrinal assertions, but I'm suggesting that in this culture that we're in, theological dialogue needs to move from the punitive, scary exclusion-inclusion spaces of the outside to the safe spaces of internal dialogue. And there's several reasons why I would say that. One is, and you heard more than enough statistics this morning, is that view of forming community solely around doctrine is profoundly, functionally challenged. Now, my reputation in Chapel Hill was I'm the kind of guy that people bring their friends to talk about things that they won't talk to their pastor about. And so, you know, I hear lots of things. And in my office was an endless parade of people whispering and saying, you know, I don't believe in hell. I'm an elder here, and I'm committed to hell in a polity sense, but I don't believe in it. Or like the 70% who believe that all people are saved. This is really what people are thinking in our congregations. And I'm not advocating those thoughts, but a lot of the doctrinally shaped church is based on what I think is a myth. And that myth is theological homogeneity. And as a result, what we produce is, if that's what we're saying, we all believe the same things, but in truth, we do not believe the same things. What we produce is a don't ask, don't tell environment. Because if we start asking and telling, we're going to find out how radically different we are on things. Some of you are going to lose your ordination. Most of you are going to lose your jobs because this is the type of environment of when we talk about kind of theological matters. And as a result, we're in a culture, and this is part of the postmodern ethos, that desperately needs authenticity. But our shape of the way we do church actually works against authenticity. So what happens is the gospel tends to be trivialized in our public discourse. It tends to be reduced to only the things that we can agree about. Like, for example, when you hear a pastor get up and say, you know, we're not going to get into political matters here. As if religious conviction has nothing to do with what we think about relationship, power, and social context. I mean, that's where we've bought into the privatization of religion that is so powerful in Western society. And in some degree, this is what happens, is we're not able to talk to each other when we need to. So that's one challenge. It's also missionally challenged, is that we, whether we like it or not, my observation is that a lot of the evangelism that we do is an evangelism of belonging before it's believing. But if our methodology is you cannot belong until you believe, then we've basically said to 19 out of 20 people, you cannot come. Our best signs, our best blog posts, our best marquees will not make people feel welcome when they realize that they have to buy in first. And that's a change in our culture. I don't like that change, but missiologically, it's something that I think we need to take very, very seriously. And I would suggest is if we could move theological space, theological conversation, because I say this in my setting, in Emmaus Way, I am the conservative. I have a bunch of folks, I didn't say this earlier, but the emergent movement has all kinds of streams in it now. I have a bunch of post-church people in our community, and their beliefs is that anything we do institutional is wrong. And they would say stuff like in our pub group, why are we a baptizing community? Why do we do the sacraments every week? Why do we use that? I mean, why are we creedal? Why do we do those? They're post-church and they're post-Christian people. And with them, I'm a stalwart conservative. I basically say to them, there's no such thing as a community without boundaries. There's no such thing as a community without things that you assert that say that we're a community. And they say, oh, no. This pub group is just like church. It's this the most sacramental thing we do because we can say anything that we want in this pub group and it's safe. And I'm like, that is absolutely not true. Let's say that I've come to pub group with an agenda of dogfighting. I'm really, really for dogfighting. And I think that we all should get really excited about dogfighting. And I mean, you guys are going to beat the crap out of me if I say that, because it's outside your acceptable umbrella. There's always something that defines us as a community. And for me, what defines me and our church is certainly the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the commitment to God's unfolding kingdom, the belief in a profound Christology. We're Trinitarian. We're lots of things. But I am suggesting that it would be exciting if we move the conversation to a safe place for that. And this is what I think will happen, is if we relocate theological dialogue, then our diversity will become an asset. Right now, diversity is something that's really scary to us because we're afraid people are going to say something that misshapes our community. But all of a sudden, when you get into safe space, then people's gender, ethnic, philosophical, whatever kind of socioeconomic diversity that they bring, all of a sudden challenges us all to be worshipers. We jump right back into the Genesis narrative where we realize, oh, that's right, creator and creature. And the minute that I realize that my perception of God is limited, I can't see God entirely. As a man, I cannot see God without the experiences of women who speak to me in friendship. I would have an entirely masculine view of God. I become a worshiper. So our diversity all of a sudden becomes something significant, catalytic, and powerful in the life of the church. As a result, we become profoundly sensitive also to differences that are out there in our bodies. I used to love to preach, and I would look out, and people just smiling at each other, and I think, okay, there's a defense against the marriage, defense against marriage act, defense against marriage act, defense against marriage act, gay couple, but they don't know it, gay couple, but they don't know it, you know, sitting together on the same row, kind of in my, and again, there was never a sense of dialogue that helped people understand that the differences in their own body were that profound. I would say, kind of as a closing comment for this, that I truly do not have all the answers on this, but I have never been more excited to be a pastor. I have never been more excited to be a Christian leader, because I'm seeing, and at least in our fellowship, that group that is more than church allergic is a group of people that are starting to embrace faith. And it's exciting to hear people who come to us who have a totally different perspective, but they get it really quickly, that this isn't some sort of watered-down Christianity, that there really is something significant. They sense, they know the power and the significance of the resurrection, and they ask me questions like this: what would it take for me to convert if I were to convert? So in other words, the language of conversion has not walked away in our fellowship. And so again, this is all from me to invite you on a journey. I do think that we are in a time of great theological change, and what it's going to take for us is it's going to take for us significant, honest, open dialogue with each other, understanding that our perspectives are really different. When I'm in the emergent setting, I have friends who are in rural churches, and they're quick to say, this is expressed really different in a rural setting. Folks who are in highly metropolitan communities would say, this is really different. Communities that say, you know, we're much more high church than you are. We have many more Anglicans, Catholics, and people who are high church. We tend to look pretty free church and all of those things. So this is an invitation for a conversation. My greatest dream would be that the existing church and the emerging church would learn from each other, and that we would not be the last defenders of modernity, but people who are missionally, opportunistically excited about the culture that we live in. I really appreciate the opportunity I've had to talk to you about this, because this is a passion of mine, so it's very, very appreciated.
Yeah, thank you very much. That was very stimulating, and I think will lead to some great conversation. To kick us off in that conversation, we have our Greek chorus, the responders that were serving us this morning. And I think we'll reverse the order this afternoon and ask Dr. Jim Veltz to respond first.
Tim, thank you very much. That was a great ride. And I have to tell you, as one of, I think, four openly practicing postmodernists on the faculty, I really enjoyed it. I'd like to just kind of go through your presentation and at various points set you some questions and make some comments. First, you talked about emergent manifesto, from your emergent manifesto, the prophetic critique of modernity. I think this is very important, and I'd like to ask you whether there is in the emergent movement a prophetic critique of postmodernity, because I personally believe that the difference between radical postmodernism and what I would call soft postmodernism is a very important distinction, and cannot simply, I mean, one cannot define postmodernity as nobody believes anything's really real or something. You don't have to get that that radical. Secondly, you went down and talked about the existing church, and you talked about the importance, and I agree with this completely, of postmodernism as being part of the oxygen that we breathe. I think it's probably worth pointing out that even in postmodernity, modernity still hangs on. Thus, even the most postmodern of us will probably get an MRI, which is a really modernist procedure. So I'm wondering how, in your experience, how they handle the overlap, so to speak, of modernity and postmodernity. You surprised me, and I was really very taken with this point that the emerging church is positive toward contextuality. And then your second point, hope, not just in eternity, but the kingdom also in this place, I believe you said. Now, here's my question. At this point, do the postmodernist emergent church people, in your experience, address lingering modernist issues with regard to sources and history as far as Christianity is concerned. Because one of the problems with postmodernism is that it has a problem with meta-narratives, and I understand why, and with rationalistic history, but Christianity is an historical religion. And one of the issues that's always brought up against a postmodern approach to the scriptures is you are bracketing key historical questions. You are retrenching into a literary sphere. And I would say somebody like Hans Frey in Eclipse of Biblical Narrative could be accused of doing that. What do we say apologetically, finally, about historical matters of an historical religion? When you got on to ethics then, this was very good, the difference between personal ethics and social ethics. And I'd like to ask this question from the standpoint of the New Testament. It seems like most of the ethics of the New Testament is unfortunately personal ethics. So when Paul says in 1 Corinthians, do you not know that murderers, adulterers, thieves, and fornicators will not enter the kingdom of heaven, he doesn't mention those who do not work for the abolition of slavery, those who are polluting the Mediterranean environment, and those who are building cheap ships and selling them for overinflated prices. Now, I don't say this to trivialize this, but I think there is a sense in which that difference between systemic social corporate ethics and the personal ethics might run aground a little bit on the what I would call the actual shape of the New Testament discussion on ethical matters. Thank you then next for your comments about exegesis of culture. I couldn't agree more. And that the existing church must turn inward. It's probably worth underscoring your point. The gospel is affected by our own understanding of it and our own expression of it. And I don't really so much have a question as to simply say thank you for that emphasis. It's a very key emphasis, and we all have to listen to that. Then moving toward the end of your presentation, you talked about moving theological dialogue from the boundaries to safer spaces of creativity. And you talked about the myth of doctrinal homogeneity, and you get to don't ask, don't tell. It won't surprise you to know that something like that is, of course, rife on a seminary campus of orthodoxy and so on and so forth. I think this is a very important reminder for us. But my question to you at this point is, while we may be ready to see sort of questionings and squishiness in that sense of doctrinal commitments, yet in the early church, people actually had to die for their faith. And there is a time in which somebody says to you, Caesar is Lord, and you have to say, Jesus is Lord. And at that point, exploration stops. Is there some point at which the emerging church movement will in fact die for the faith, the people who are in the safe internal? I don't want to minimize that, but at some point, especially maybe not in your ministry or my ministry, but maybe in their ministry, we may be at that point. And then finally, your discussion of community and community without boundaries. There is no community without boundaries. but that we must have conversation, a safe space. Diversity is an asset. Again, looking at the general contours of the New Testament witness, our Lord certainly did exemplify a lot of this. He spent time hanging out with tax collectors and sinners, and as I often point out to my classes, there's a reason why they said that you remember Jesus' statement. He says, you're like children in the marketplace. You say, we piped and you did not dance. We sang the threnody melody, you did not mourn. Well, John the Baptist came not eating and drinking, and you got mad at him. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and the point is, that characterization must have been able to stick. So he did, in fact, spend a lot of his time hanging out with people like that. But there was a point at which he draws away with his disciples. And he finally has his final Passover with the institution of the Lord's Supper with his disciples. He is not having it with a kind of a general seeker group of loose women, tax collectors, and murderers. Now, he has those who have committed themselves to him and have left that lifestyle. But there is a sense in which he moves between two worlds. And I'm wondering if there is a kind of a two-world phenomenon that has to be embraced here. Thank you very much for your presentation. Absolutely, tremendously presented, and you have laid a lot before us to consider. Thank you.
David, is it all right if we have Tim respond to Jim's points that he raises? It might, so that we don't lose track of things. I think we've got time in the session to do that. So if you wouldn't mind, we'll give you a chance to respond to Dr. Veltz.
Well, based on the quality of those questions, you guys are in good hands. For me, one of the things that I think you can tell a lot about people is the quality of questions they ask. And when you get a question that's so far afield from what you're trying to say, and that happens to me all the time. Maybe it's my preaching style, but the quality of questions are phenomenal there. One comment that I wanted to make on the different worlds, this is working backwards, is that just to be. I was almost a little bit nervous about my kind of tattoo and body art kind of comment, is that our congregation is not seekers at all in that sense. These are people who are really radically committed to the gospel, committed to the point where there's several people, unfortunately including the pastor, who are very downwardly mobile economically, people who have sold homes and moved to places for missional import, have made, and so in some ways that wasn't what you were saying, but I just think it's a caricature of the emerging church, that it's kind of maybe seekerish people, but maybe a little bit cooler than the baby boomers that went to Willow Creek 20 years ago, and that's not the case at all. I mean, in terms of our community, the gospel is taken so seriously, and to some degree, we have our errors. I mean, I jokingly love giving like this fictional fight between the person who drives an SUV, which will get you in real trouble in our area, to a person who maybe has a big vehicle but buys all their food locally. So that language of proximity, the language of sacrifice and commitment, is really, really significant. In fact, a person who came to our fellowship who didn't get it the first time said, is there anything that you're willing to do to offend postmodern people? And I laughed at that. Was one of those questions that showed that person had absolutely no clue, because he was expecting offense to come in sermon authoritarian statements. That for him was preaching. And our dialogue style, I sit actually in a stool in the round, and we do dialogue, and I underprepare intentionally so that people can speak. And I said, we do the Eucharist every week, and we describe what that is. There could be few things more offensive than that. So I throw that out as a question. Your comment about prophetic critique of postmodernism, this is, I think, that's right on the money.
And that's one of the things I think that has changed pretty radically in the emergent community over, I think, 10 or 15 years ago, we were kind of in love of all things postmodern because it was new. When Stanley Grentz wrote his book, A Primer on Postmodernism, probably an outstanding book, but the biggest critique in that book is it doesn't distinguish between continental thought and North American postmodernity. And most of the things, whether it's Nancy Murphy, who wrote about Anglo-American postmodernity or others, there is a pretty vivid conversation, at least around the people that I'm around, of kind of critiquing postmodernity. Because again, there's that, Brian McLaren couched that term, that there may have been a few drunk graduate students somewhere 10 or 15 years ago that said there is no reality except a language event, that this table is not there. But except for those few drunk graduate students, there's really no one who believes those things. And so that has happened over the last several years, is that this understanding that at postmodernity, the gospel is a meta-narrative. And it is going to collide with postmodernity in a pretty powerful way, in the same way that the higher criticism, evolution, and other things were huge challenges in the gospel in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. So that's, I appreciate your saying that, because that is, from a scholar, that needs to be said very well. My handwriting is so terrible. The sense of, let me skip down to kind of die for your commitments. This is important, is that one of the things that when you make a new comment about theological dialogue, there's always this fear that there's no language of assertion. And there are times where I get up and speak to people and I'm absolutely horrified. In my community, one of the things that I'm really, for you, I might be afraid to say, move theological dialogue and don't shape community based on doctrine. In my community, what I'm scared to say is that the Bible does not affirm moral autonomy. You don't get to kind of make up your world morally and then ask Jesus to bless that. Because that really is the culture that we live in, is that it's part of our entitlement, whether it's postmodern or late modernism, the whole idea that God is committed to bless my lifestyle is not a biblical thought. And so when I say those things, I'm pretty nervous because I know I'm going to get some tough emails and I'm going to have a really busy week that week in terms of sitting and talking with people. I think your second question, let me see if I've got this, is that is talking about the kingdom in this place and lingering modernist concerns about sources and histories. Again, this is where I do think that the emerging church has made a pretty good move away from an over-identification with postmodernism. I guess Brian McLaren is probably the most well-known voice of the emerging church. His chapter actually in this book is entitled, Why I Say the Word Postmodern Still, But I'm Nervous About It. Is the sense that that I do think that, and the reality in the church world, one of the things I didn't say is that there, in the multiple streams in the emerging church, one of those streams is what I call transition churches. In those churches, which are the most common, you have a deeply embedded modernity and a deeply embedded postmodernity side by side, and you can move from one place to the other. When I do kind of church and transition seminars, you can see those people because you see both languages. Usually it's like two people on one staff on one side and three on the other, and they're nudging each other and saying, this is why we don't understand each other. So I do think that that's the reality that we're in, is both of those kind of epistemological thought structures are existing side by side. I'm thinking that I'm forgetting one more question, and it may have been on the notion of ethics and social ethics. And I'm not sure I have a great answer to that question. I know the Dukies that I hang out with would probably consider that fighting words in terms of I'm right on the, we have more Duke Divinity students in our church than we need in a church of 60 or 70. In some ways we think about putting a sign, no more Howard Wass Mafia, no more John Howard Yoderites. We got it. We got it. But one of the, in our community, community, probably the two of the most significant books for us are Body Politics by Yoder and The Politics of Jesus. And so certainly we are deeply influenced by an Anabaptist tradition and that understanding of kind of a political reading of the New Testament. So in some ways, these are things that are fairly new to me. In fact, I say this, and some of you who are young will do this too, is I basically had to burn down my seminary education. I caught it at the wrong time, and everybody that was 32 or younger had read the books that I needed to read, and all the books that I had read for the most part were ones that no one cared about anymore. And so this is an area, you know, ethics and patristics and sacramental theology. I'm reading every book that I possibly can. That was not part of my training. So I have a sense that I'd like to have a really good response to that, but I'm going to pass on it.
Dr. David Peter, second respondent.
Tim, thanks so much. I learned so much and just kind of imbibed what you could provide, and I could just sit and listen to you hour upon hour here, although maybe not tonight. But I'm looking forward to what you have to say to us tomorrow as well. I'm going to try to integrate a lot of the elements of your presentation more into one specific observation, and hopefully that will lead to some questions for you here. And I think what I especially appreciated about your presentation here, which is also something I appreciate about the emerging church movement, is its holistic approach, okay? That it emphasizes holism, the holistic historical narrative, and that's a both-and approach rather than an either-or. Now, I recognize that there are some times when it's necessary to distinguish and differentiate, that there are situations where you have to have either-or, and we in Lutheranism certainly have theses and antitheses and so forth, which do that. But your emphasis here on both and, the existing church, the emerging church, it's not either or, it's not a competition or a combative approach there. Your emphasis on hope being both hope for the future and also hope here in the present that we can bring to the world. Again, your emphasis on history, that it's not just selected periods of history, but the whole narrative of history, I think is very, very helpful. You discussed the collisions then between the existing church and the emerging church, and that almost hit me as being more either or than both and, though. And maybe you didn't intend it, and if so, correct me on that. Where the existing church needs to be thinking more in terms of social ethics, whereas the emerging church has dismissed more the personal morality. Isn't that an area where we can see the scriptural witness as both and? As Jim indicated here, there is much scripture that exhorts us to live lives of personal morality. But then you also have the prophetic literature, particularly in the Old Testament, which does speak to social ethics and societal concerns there. So again, it's not either or, but both and. The same is true with the community formation. Is it based on doctrine and confession or on ethical commitments? Well, again, I don't think that it needs to be an either or, but a both and. The existing church can be enriched by a greater appreciation of formation through ethical commitments, but that doesn't mean that we abandon formation based on doctrine and confession. And then the same is true in terms of your discussion on the exclusion and inclusion spaces, to provide a safe place for dialogue in our churches and in our Christian communities. But then you contrasted that with what you called the myth of theological homogeneity. And I'm wondering if, again, it's not either or, but both can be complementary, where a community will affirm what its theological confession is, and yet provide safe space for dialogue about theology and other matters. I notice on your website, you do have, I don't know if you would call it subscription to the ecumenical creeds, but in the sense that is obviously a confession, and there is at least some degree of theological homogeneity that is advocated there. And maybe I'm miscomprehending what you're saying here. Maybe that's your intention, that it be more inclusive, both and. But I was hearing a bit more antagonistic contrast there. Okay, so that's more what I'd like you to address, if you can, and clarify for me. I do certainly want to affirm what you state at the very beginning, however, that our culture needs two churches, that we can be complementary and collaborative with one another, the existing and the emerging church, that there's no need to be polarized necessarily. However, we need to hold one another accountable doctrinally, ethically, missionally. I think that kind of accountability still needs to exist. I'm reminded of Galatians chapter 2, where Paul says that Paul was appointed to be an apostle to the Gentiles. Peter was appointed to be an apostle to the Jews. But God worked through both. And obviously, in that society of the first century, you had different cultures, and God was using these personages and the movements that they represented to address these different cultures and to bring the gospel to these different cultures. But God was working through both. And I find it interesting that Peter, as kind of the apostle to the Jews, in one sense, held Paul accountable. Paul was brought to the Council of the Apostles, and Peter was a part of that in Acts 15. And then Paul goes on later on in Acts chapter 2 to describe how Peter was brought to accountability by Paul himself. And so by way of analogy, I'm wondering if maybe that's not an image that we can use for the working together of the existing and the emerging churches. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Peter. In fact, that's a great example of kind of why I love preaching in community, kind of our process. I'll talk about this in seminars tomorrow, about having a textual community. The whole process of preparing sermons is that, you know, you never say it the way you want to say it, you know, no matter how hard you tried. One of the things that I think I really appreciate your feedback on that, the collisions. Let me underline this. I didn't want that to be in the language of advocacy. That was more the language of what's happening out there. It disappoints me profoundly that emerging churches and existing churches look at each other and refer to the other as immoral. Because for me, the gospel embraces both of those things, the social ethics as well as personal ethics. So that's a good clarification, that those collisions of community formation and ethics are sadly two of the areas areas where we get into our ugliest spaces between each other. But I don't see that as a language of advocacy. But the corrective that you put, I think this is really helpful for me, is that, you know, one of the biases that I bring, we all bring biases to these things. One of the biases that I bring is that I kind of got on this thing fairly early and took a lot of punches for about 15 or 20 years. I started out in a mega church in New England and, you know, was kind of favored son and punching bag at the same time. They broke the rules for me, as well as, I took the grief over questions related to gender and context and all sorts of things. So what I have to be careful with when I speak on these things is I have a huge passion about what kind of the don't ask, don't tell world does to us, because I see the pain that produces. And obviously a church like ours does draw a lot of people. We have four or five kind of former pastors who are a part of our body, and they have been brutalized. I mean, they have just had every, you know what, kicked out of them in every which way. So I get pretty passionate about that. But actually, as you said, I really do intend those things to be both ands in this way, is that with in our community, with our post-church people, that's what I argue with them about, is that we're creedal, we're sacramental, we affirm the historic story. That actually was the question I didn't, is we really affirm the historical story of Christianity. We're Christians, you know, that we don't really have a lively post-Christian kind of debate in our community. There's some that want it, and what I say to them is I really value post-Christian voices in our church. I mean, I would be really disappointed if we lost the people who deeply loved us but really thought that we were making a mistake by being Christians, because their critique is so significant. What they say to us is the blind spot that we don't see. But I do have to say to them, we're Christians. We are committed to that. And you're right on our website in terms of, and in fact, I think our website is a little soft on that. I think I've had three or four conversations this week alone as I'm kind of getting into this journey of year two and three of, we need to say more about boundaries. Like, for example, we have a guy in our congregation who was an elder in another denomination, not yours, who was being excommunicated. And I was kind of horrified of the process, the accusations, some that were accurate and some that were inaccurate based on divorce. And I wasn't really excited about the whole exegetical, hermeneutical process of how they made judgments about that divorce. And at one point, I was like, guys, I'm the witness against why that charge is false. And so, this person was just, his life was transformed. He went from a guy that, 16, 17 months ago was sitting there holding a scotch bottle all night long and a bottle of pills, and really wondering, maybe in my tradition, maybe I should kill myself rather than go through the divorce that seems inevitable. Here he is 18 months later, and just an amazing, gifted artist in our community. He's been through a whole process, and he loves us. I mean, he absolutely loves us. But I grabbed him one time, and I said, Mark, I got to tell you, I know that the process that you were in was unbelievably unfair. It was the worst part of kind of denominational hierarchy without asking really specific questions about what's going on. But you do know that you can't sleep with middle school girls or sell drugs on the street after the Mayus Way. In other words, there's things you can't do here. You get that, right? I mean, there are things that are offensive to us. And he's like, oh, yeah, I understand. But that's, I think, a very good assertion, is that in talking about the importance of dialogue, the importance of hearing people's voices, sometimes in my passion, I think what can get lost is that there are commitments that we have to die for. And I think that it's very true in postmodern society. I'm not entirely sure where those places are. I know the most painful ones for me have been people that I truly just totally understand and jive with their critique, jive with their pain. But I have to say that I can't manipulate the gospel entirely to fit what you hope is out of it, because the gospel is something we receive. It's not something that we construct. So, Dr. Peter, I really appreciate your pointing it out. One thing I would say, this is my icon text on this whole thing, and everybody always has something they appeal to. Have you guys read Henry Nouwen's Reaching Out? That's been the most significant pastoral book in my life. He talks about three movements of the spiritual life. One of those movements is from hostility to hospitality. And he, I think,
makes the signature statement on hospitality. He says that basically it's two things. It's receptivity, and I'm talking about radical receptivity. It's not intimidating people with good books, good, you know, good china, and being able to cook better than them. It's not a Martha Stewart kind of like, I got more than you got, but you can enjoy it for this evening because you're in my house. It is, as he puts it, it's the freedom to sing your own songs and dance your own dances. It is a radical receptivity that says you do not have to change to be in my presence. But then the second part of hospitality for him is honesty. He says that it's not hospitable for me to invite Luke into my home and then ignore him and to not be a real presence in his life. So to be hospitable to him, I need to be thoroughly honest about what type of person I am, and I need to be influenced by the songs and dances that he brings to my home. And what we get wrong with hospitality in our culture, and we get this wrong missiologically, is we're committed to, and an emerging church is open to this criticism, radical receptivity without perhaps radical honesty, or perhaps maybe not enough depth of reflection to know what to be honest about. And I would say the existing church would probably go the other way. We'll plop a placard in your face or a pamphlet or our doctrinal statements, but we really aren't that receptive at times. We say welcome, but we do want you to change your clothes and change your speech and change a lot of things about you to come in that place. So that to me is my marching orders for pastoral ministry, is to try to in some way live out the hospitality that Nouwen talks about. And I'm constantly saying to myself, what is receptive here and what is honest here? And I think that's a good challenge for emerging church persons like myself. This is actually why we need you guys, is that that we really need to be studying Scripture together and living in the history of the Christian tradition, so that we're appropriately, missionally, contextually honest for what the gospel means in this time and place. So, Dr. Peter, those are great. Those are just fantastically accurate things. So I would also say one last thing, that that seminaries are I really appreciate that comment, can be phenomenally unsafe places for questioning. My time at Gordon-Conwell, I remember one time meeting a new professor, and the school had become much more reformed in that process. And I was asking questions, and I could tell I was ticking off this professor. I mean, he really was offended that I, know-nothing, 23-year-old seminarian, was asking him questions. And finally, my buddy, who was kind of a theological giant, somebody that you'd probably recognize his name now, said, "It's okay, doctor, he believes in the limited atonement," you know? And he had no idea what I believed in, but the guy just lightened up right there. If you've got the limited atonement, we're safe to talk to each other. So that's something to be wary of in theological settings, is what can you not say? Close on that one.